I want to give you a little bit of background introduction, but Council of Churches was a long time in formation. Actually, it was heading toward being formed in the 1930s, and the war broke out in Europe. And so it was delayed until the first assembly in 1948 in Amsterdam. Now, previous to that, there were a number of ecumenical type happenings and movements in different parts of what was chiefly the North Atlantic world. In 1910, there was a Faith and Order meeting in Edinburgh that began to pull together the theologians and those who were worried about the faith issues, the definition of the faith, the meaning of faith in the modern world, and were worried about the fragmentation of the Christian understanding of that. It was a handicap just about everywhere the church tried to work, in the mission fields or in relation to governments or in its own self-understanding with young people who were coming up for confirmation. If the church is basically one in its faith, then how come there's so many versions? And why do we have to buy into a particular tract? And so those unity issues and the faith and order issues, for instance, what everybody sort of senses as a scandal, that Christians can't commune at the Lord's table together because of certain inherited order principles, certain definitions of things, or a scandal that some churches don't recognize Christian baptism the way other churches do it, or that some churches don't recognize the ministers of other churches and won't allow them in their pulpits or to celebrate the sacraments. Now, those issues began to bubble up during this century, not because theologians sat down in a library and said this is a scandal, but because working Christians all over the place sort of said this is silly. This isn't what the Lord wants, and therefore why can't we get it together? So faith and order was one of those tracts. A second one was life and work, which had its first big meeting in 1919. And it was the one that saw the difficulties of presenting any unified witness in the world, First World War, for instance. How could the churches manifest the Christian witness in a better way? How could they cooperate on the mission fields better? How could they get together on aid mechanisms better? Because simply every time you dealt with an aid problem or any kind of Christian activity, if you had to have it sliced X number of ways in every country, and if it was international, sliced even more, it didn't make sense. And so out of this century have come a number of different parts of the ecumenical movement. The International Missionary Council went way back into the days when they were going into Africa to preach the gospel. And here the disciples and the Presbyterians and the Lutherans and the Methodists from U.S. and Germany and Scotland and Switzerland and France would all be on each other's turf. And so pretty soon the mission agencies began dividing up in what was called committee arrangements, so that they wouldn't fight each other on the mission fields. Way back in the 1870s, there was an International Sunday School Association out of the mission movements, and it chiefly was just originally the British and the Canadians and the Americans, but that made it international. And so they began to have meetings that brought together all those who wanted to extend Sunday schools around the world as part of the mission effort. So that there were four or five or six basic kinds of unifying movements going on, not even counting those that were not church in a narrow sense, like the YWCA, which became worldwide, the YMCA, which became worldwide, the World Student Christian Federation, which also was part of that. So in 1948, they finally had the first assembly, and the decision was made to make it a council of churches. Now, when you make a council of churches, you buy into the organizational models of the churches in different nations. That means that the World Council tends to reflect the ways the churches organize themselves. That means that it tends to be a bishop's and a preacher's game. Now, there are some Christian conferences that organize differently. The Christian Conference of Asia is not a council of churches, and so it can include as members the YMCA, the YWCA, the women's organizations, and so forth, in an official way, in a way the World Council cannot. The Caribbean Conference of Churches is the only major regional conference that includes the Roman Catholic Church. But they are full members, charter members, from the very beginning of the Caribbean Conference of Churches, and one of their key church leaders is always in the presidium, the president group, or the top three people of the Caribbean Conference. Now, the World Council, when it began, concentrated on those two areas, faith and order and life and work. In 1961, there were two significant additions at the Third Assembly in New Delhi, India. One of them was the International Missionary Council, which joined and brought in its program for theological education. It was funding theological seminary development around the world. And it brought in all of the parts that moved into world mission and evangelism that the Red International Review of Mission reports. The second thing that happened there was the joining of into the World Council of the Orthodox churches of the world, most of them. That included the Greek Orthodox Church, which has been the state church of Greece for a long, long time. The Coptic Orthodox Church of Egypt, which is about 4 or 5 million people, 10% of the population of Egypt, the rest of which is Muslim. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church, the Martoma and Syrian Orthodox Churches of Lebanon in the Middle East and India, and the Orthodox Churches in Bulgaria, and most important of that group in Eastern Europe are the Russian Orthodox Churches. And the Russian Orthodox Church is a huge church that goes way back into the history of Russia. So that brought a significant kind of non-Western Christian presence into the World Council. The Orthodox churches, even into this assembly, feel a bit alienated because the World Council, having been started in the North Atlantic world, and being in Switzerland inevitably takes on a kind of Western style. And the Orthodox churches have a different style. Many of those churches have lived under persecution for centuries, and they have a very rich liturgical tradition. They maintain continuity without a whole lot of school-type stuff, the way Western rational folks do. And it's just a different form of Christianity historically. And so one of the tensions since 1961 in the World Council has been how to bring together the Orthodox churches with their deep tradition back into the New Testament period in relative isolation from the Western churches. For instance, to the Orthodox, the Reformation is a little blip. It's a little kind of incident in Western church history. Well, to an old Calvinist like me, or to most of the Lutheran colleagues over there, that's where you begin thinking about what the church is, with either Luther or Calvin, and then you go on back to Scripture and so forth, you know. Well, it's just a different style. They go back to the fathers of the church. They go back to the great separations in the first 10 centuries of church history that over one issue or another split the Orthodox churches among themselves. So, the Roman Catholic Church is not a member of the World Council of Churches. During the years, it has continually been related in various ways. The mechanism for that at the moment is the Joint Working Group. And in one of those green ecumenical reviews, you might pass those, if that's been around, you may have seen it. There's the final report of the Joint Working Group to the Vancouver Assembly. And this report for this assembly is the most discouraging in many ways of the whole relationship with the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church has, after Vatican II, there were hopes with Pope John and then with Paul VI that it might really join. If that had happened, it would not have been possible for the World Council just to say, okay, you're a new member church. Because the Roman Catholic Church, unlike the other churches, can't just define itself as the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. or the Swedish Lutheran Church or whatever it may be. Those 303 member churches are all identified with nations. Not neatly, because some of the Orthodox spill over the boundaries as some of ours do, but the Roman Church wouldn't fit that model. And the Roman Church also is much bigger than any of the others, bigger than the whole membership of the World Council around the world, of those churches. So if they had, or when they do, get ready to come together in some kind of global organization, it will force a radical reconstruction of the whole business. And of course, there are people in the World Council of Churches who don't particularly like Rome, and who don't want to think about that kind of domination by the big church in the game, and so they aren't too eager always to go to Rome and initiate conversations either. But the official activity has always been most open and most positive. And from time to time, as when Soda Pacts, which was back about 15 years ago, and social justice, development, and peace issues, after Vatican II, the Vatican started a social pontifical commission on justice and peace. And when I was on the staff from 69 to 75, we had a number of good activities with them. The Roman Catholics participate in the Faith and Order Commission. They have collegial relationships that are working in many different ways. And at the grassroots level, often things really bubble along far beyond what the mechanisms will approve or recognize. Intercommunion happens. Protestants go to Roman Catholic masses and Catholics participate in our Eucharist without any real problem, because most of the local people don't let all those organized inheritances of divisions get in the way. The best expression of this that I heard over there was, we had a lady on our committee named Janet Wasonga, who was an Anglican. She was the mayor of her little village in Uganda, and she was on our committee and on the central committee. After one of these long two-hour debates in the Central Committee about the relations with the Roman Catholics and the report of the Joint Working Group and so forth, she finally got up and she said, "Well, we're doing fine in Uganda. We cooperate well and no real problems. We just hope you won't mess us up in Rome and Geneva." And that's often the kind of lay grassroots feeling toward the laborious process of working out all of these constitutional type, structure type questions. Now, let me move to the assembly. Each 7 or 8 years, the assembly meets. 1948 in Amsterdam, 1954 in Evanston, Illinois, 1961 in Delhi, 1968 in Uppsala, Sweden, and 1975 in Nairobi, and that was the one that I was deeply involved in from the Office of Education. This one is in Canada after an eight-year gap in Vancouver. Now, the member churches elect representatives to the assembly, and that's a complicated process. If they had their way and followed their customs, the assembly would be almost entirely ordained bishops and preachers and males. And the churches are more restless than that, even in their own assemblies back home. And so there's been a conscious effort over the last two or three assemblies to get more lay participation and more women participation and more youth participation. The problem is that the churches want to send people who are good connecting link people in their own churches, who can bring back to the churches what happens in the World Council and who can represent them well over there. And until there are more lay people and more women in those bridge positions in leadership of the churches, then when you put women and lay people in, they often are, or local pastors even, they are not as effective in that connection either way. So that's part of the problem. But this assembly will have more women than any other assembly, proportionately. It will have more lay people. It also will have more people who have never been at an assembly before. The generation of old timers is sort of passing off the scene. And that means that this assembly is in many ways the least predictable in the history of the World Council. That makes some of my former colleagues on the staff pretty nervous, because an assembly is a very complicated process. And they naturally feel better if they have a kind of sense of how the agenda is going to work itself out and who are going to be the natural leaders and spokespersons for various viewpoints. This assembly is not as predictable, and so I hope you'll watch the news and listen and get through your church circles some good reports to see what new kinds of things come. I, for one, think it's a good thing to have an assembly that's less predictable, but as one of the leaders of our Presbyterian church once said, an assembly is like a herd of cattle. They can easily be stampeded. And it'll be interesting to see whether this assembly gets stampeded. Usually that does not happen in the World Council, because the model of decision making has to represent so much diversity from around the world that a simple Presbyterian rational Robert's Rules of Order way of taking a vote and settling it, we think, doesn't really happen. They wouldn't think of having an important decision made on a 60-40 vote, because the chances are the 40% would represent such a substantial part of the Christian experience somewhere in the world that they would be very unwise to move ahead on that kind of divided vote. Now, back home in our more comfortable provincialism in the Presbyterian Church, the Lutherans may not play this game, but if we win by 60-40, we think we've done something. But we know deep down, if we win the 40%, we'd be quite sure that the devil had led that majority instead of the Holy Spirit. And we'd do everything we could to block it until the next assembly and hope we'd get 51% and overturn it the next round. But the World Council can't operate so smoothly, because it just is too diverse. So what often happens is, when there's a very controversial kind of issue, they'll have hearings on it, and as happens in much of the world, they'll delay decision until the differences are worked out to where they have a solid consensus before they try to move ahead. So the assembly will be that kind of thing. Now, the assembly lasts nearly 3 weeks, and that's enough to make the efficient American types just climb the wall. The American style is a much more hurried style. Our General Assembly lasts 7 or 8 days, and the people who go there from busy offices think that that's more than the Lord deserves, and they fuss at the delays and all that sort of thing. In the World Council, because of the diversity and the need to get to know each other, they set a different kind of style. And what they do in that is to have Bible study in small groups, something like 15 or 20 hours of these 20 days up there. We'll be spent in groups about this size, where they'll take some passages and talk about the Feast of Life, and instead of all the faces being white the way ours are, instead of it being our kind of people, which basically we are, everybody here probably English mother tongue, not much diversity in our cultural background or our means of communication. We kind of know how to hear each other speak and how to read the signals that are not just in words. Without that, with a number of different mother tongues, with 3 or 4 or 5 interpretive languages going so you can study it, with Christian experience from the poor part of the world, from the eastern countries in Europe part of the world, from the Asian countries where they live as 1% Christians in a sea of Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam. By the time you look at some text together with that kind of diversity, you begin to have to develop different ears, some new kinds of antenna, and you have to start speaking more clearly and more slowly and quit using the colloquialisms that we can enjoy using back home for people who are having to hear what you say in a second or third or sometimes even fourth language. So that the process has to take time to mellow enough so people know how to listen to one another. And as that happens in the small groups, in the worship, in the committee meetings, and they begin to get to the business in the second week more heavily, as that begins to happen, then people are able to affirm each other's Christian experience and not block off something that sounds crazy from one perspective. So everybody comes to the World Council Provincial because everybody lives local. And so what happens from different parts of the Christian world when things are said is it's always a kind of surprising insight to people from another part of the world. So the kinds of reactions we get in the U.S. or Germany or Britain to things that the World Council does or expressions that come out of it are equally surprising sometimes when it's very comfortable to us but not comfortable to the Christians in the Orthodox Church in Japan or in the Kyodan or in the Batak Church in Indonesia or wherever it may be. So that you have to get a sense of it, and it just takes a long time to have an assembly. I, for one, found it sort of chafing to spend that much time, but the richness that results from that is a richness that you just cannot get unless you do serious harm to some major part of the church by squeezing it and hurrying it and focusing on business-type decisions that require a kind of shallow vote without the deep understanding or attempt to understand different viewpoints. Now, that's more sermon than you were ready for at that point. But let me go back and sort of run through the outline, and then let's come back to some of the questions you'd like. The assembly elects members from its own representatives to a central committee of 130 or 40 people. And that committee meets every 18 months or so till the next assembly. And it carries out all of the priorities, it supervises the programs, it approves staff, and guides the World Council into the next period. The Central Committee then elects at its first meeting 20 or 25 or 30 members of an executive committee who meet every 6 months or so in between meetings of the Central Committee. And then there are three or four officers that can meet on the phone or meet if there's a need in between those 6 months, so that the assembly narrows down to a Central Committee, to an executive committee, to the officers. Underneath those is the General Secretariat. Philip Potter is the third General Secretary. The first one was Vissatooft, who was the young Dutch theologian who was working in the 30s to get the thing going, who lived in Switzerland waiting for the war to be over, and along with many of his other colleagues were deeply involved in such things as helping refugees escape over the mountain to the train down to southern France where they could get to Spain and get a ship to the U.S. or to Latin America or somewhere. In 1939, there was a huge youth convention, I think in Holland, maybe in Amsterdam, that brought together young people from all the churches of Europe and the U.S. and a sprinkling from the other parts of the world. That was such an emotional occasion right there in the middle of what was then exploding into the Second World War. And after 6 or 7 years of Hitler rule in Germany, the German delegates did not know quite what to do with the way their government had gone. The French delegates were scared. The British delegates were scared. The Dutch and Belgians knew it was going to come through them. And that group of young people really brought some of the emotion into the World Council 9 years later. And when I was over there, they would still have a kind of alumni meeting. Every time there was a big meeting, one of these folks who'd been at that youth meeting would have the others out for dinner or something. They ran into each other in concentration camps, when in all kinds of crazy places during the war. And the Christian bonding of that generation came out of the fires of that war into the World Council of Churches, and that carried much of the momentum. That generation is just about to die off. At the Vancouver Assembly, they probably could get the alumni group around one table. Visitooft is 80 years old. He won't be able to come to this assembly. Many of the others are just too old to come now. Some of them will be there. Philip Potter was a youth delegate. And there are some others that are in their 50s and 60s now, and they'll undoubtedly have the alumni meeting up at Vancouver. The second General Secretary was Eugene Carson Blake. He was chairman of the Finance Committee when Visitooft retired and had been a leading ecumenical figure in the U.S. churches. In many ways, a fortunate appointment. It's perceived historically as sort of an interim, because after the long leadership of Visitooft, whoever followed him would inevitably not stay as long or make that kind of impact. But it was during Eugene Carson Blake's general secretariat that the world economy fell apart. And that was a severe shock. When we went over in 1969, $1 brought 4.28 Swiss francs. And when we were over there a couple of months ago, it was 1.9. Now, that big shift in money values happened in the early 70s. And that meant that the money that had been coming to the World Council in the early years, 80% of it or so came from the U.S. churches. And a whole lot of it was involved in rebuilding the churches of Europe. Right now, the West Germans give slightly more to the whole picture than do the American churches. But those two churches give far more than half of the total income of the World Council, because that's where the strength of the churches is, that's where the money of the world is. So that when Blake was there, he had to try to help the council weather that crisis, a severe loss in funds, not due to churches giving less. In fact, the American churches and the German churches have increased their giving while they've had to cut back on other things at home. But the net receipt in Geneva went down. The third General Secretary was Philip Potter, and when he came in as the first Third World General Secretary, he's from the little island of Dominica in the Caribbean, and he's black, and had been part of the Methodist Mission Network. He'd also been head of the Youth Department of the World Council and head of World Mission and Evangelism. When he was elected, many of the white North Atlantic church people saw it as a kind of radical shift, indicating the new emergence in the World Council of all these churches in the Third World who, as their nations became independent of the mission domination and became churches of their own, like the Presbyterian Church in Congo, like the Lutheran Church in Tanzania, and so forth. So that all of these churches increasingly began to make their presence felt in the World Council, and the election of Philip in many ways was symbolic of that. Now, the interpretation of that was very loaded in many ways. Time magazine ran a front cover of Philip's face, a black face, and in the shadowy background they had a black gorilla, they said, with a gun. And they quoted something on it that was not Philip's quotation at all. And the combination of that imagery made it look, 10 years ago when Philip was elected, as if the World Council were suddenly going radical. Now, when that sort of thing began to happen, the black Christians from the world, and the estimates are that by the year 2000, the continent with the most Christians may well be Africa. The center of gravity shifts south as the Christian membership and strength declines in the northern hemisphere and increases in the southern hemisphere. Now, those black Christians would come to the meetings and they'd say, why is it that the white press in the northern hemisphere calls our freedom fighters guerrillas or terrorists? You don't call George Washington a guerrilla fighter or a terrorist, although that was the game he was in, et cetera, et cetera. So that there's a fundamental kind of questioning of the dominating interpretation that's put in the press of the white world, of the U.S., of Germany, and Britain, and so forth. And we basically control the news flow and interpretation around the world. so that that conversation goes on every time there's a significant meeting. Not just in the World Council, those issues are also raised when the Vatican calls together the Synod of Bishops, and increasingly the bishops from what they, like us, call former mission territories. They are now major national conferences of bishops, and as they come into the meetings in Rome, they raise the same questions. When the conservative evangelicals meet in Lausanne or wherever they meet, if it's a seriously representative group of Christians, then those who come from the underside of the economic world, the blacks, who always hear their liberation efforts, their independence struggles, their revolutionary wars, described as terrorists and guerrillas, they always look the white Christians in the eye and say, why? Why do you do it that way? And can't the church do more to paint a better picture for what's really going on in the world and the involvement of Christian people in these struggles to throw off colonialism and different forms of dependence? Anyway, that's the kind of conversation that goes on because of the makeup of the council. Now, I think I'll just stop. This is the organizational picture, and if you want any more information about that, I'll be glad to give it. But let me let you have a chance to come back. Yes.
You mentioned the evangelicals just now. What's the relationship between, I don't know, they met in your son, that's the direction.
Well, it's a mixed connection. 70% of the delegates to the Lausanne meeting were members of member churches of the World Council of Churches. So that for those delegates, many of them from the third world, that kind of division that tends to look to them as if it comes out of European and American over the last century or two, don't make that much sense, just as the division into denomination don't make that much sense when they're exported from the U.S. or from Germany or Switzerland or whatever. On the other hand, there are a significant number of people who, within the members of the World Council of Churches, the member churches, as well as in the conservative evangelicals, who have been increasingly worried over the last decade as the World Council has tried through that all that long process of negotiation with member churches to focus on the issues of justice and peace, on the issues of survival. And many of the activities of the World Council, particularly the program to combat racism, have raised fears that they have moved from their theological ground into what is called political activity. Now, at the same time you say that, you have to recognize that among the conservative evangelicals in this country, for instance, Ron Sider and the Sojourners and the publication The Other Side, evangelicals for social action are equally worried that in the fear of that, the conservative evangelical tradition is in danger of not addressing those problems when their theology clearly holds that God is interested in the social as well as in the personal. So that you have within the World Council that same tension between conservative, if you could call it that, and more social action-oriented folks, just as you have in the Catholic Synod of Bishops, just as you have in the conservative evangelical. Other questions that you wanted to follow up on from earlier? Oh, does the World Council include non-Christians? No, it does not. The basis of membership is this, and this is the quote, "It is a fellowship of churches which confess the Lord Jesus Christ as God and Savior according to the Scriptures and therefore seek to fulfill their common calling to the glory of one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit." One of the programs, the dialogue program, that was started after Uppsala is a dialogue program with people in groups of other faiths and ideologies. And they have initiated and worked steadily for the last 13 years now, on dialogue with the Buddhists, with the Muslims, with the Jews, with the Hindus, and with those for whom ideological commitment is a religious type thing, like certain groups of Marxists and so forth. so that this is the agency of direct contact with all of those groups. And it's done a very promising kind of work. One of the interesting things is that as the threats to survival of the human race become more obvious, the common concern of the great religious families of the world for maintaining what it means to be human become more important. And the differences are seen as in the light of that greater kind of concern that we not destroy ourselves. So that the dialogue program is that, but no, there no, this is about as solid a Christian basis as you could write.
Yeah, well, that's, the propaganda is the World Council of Churches has begun to identify with the Muslims and the non-Christian groups, and I suppose it's because of the dialogue.
It may well be from those particular programs. It may also be the more general thing that it's very understandable how a person like me growing up in a local Presbyterian church in Spartanburg, South Carolina, if I had lived there like many of the people I graduated from high school and had not roamed around and had some of these experiences, it's very easy for me to think that the Presbyterian version with a Southern American accent, basically white, liking good music, all the trappings of our culture that are part of my local church back there, that that's the way God wants it to be. And that he or she really hears prayers with a Southern American accent a little clearer than he does those with a Swedish accent or whatever it may be. Now, if you put it that way, you see how ridiculous it is, but it's not ridiculous to people whose basic Christian experience is with people like themselves, which is the way our free church heritage in the U.S. has allowed us to develop. We don't, by and large, have the Catholic parish sense that everybody inside of the church or the cathedral belongs to that parish, rich or poor, black or white, Hispanic or Anglo or whatever. We tend to use our mobility to bring people into a local congregation who are alike and who tend to like the same form of expression of faith, who tend to come from the same tradition, who tend to be of the same race, of the same cultural standard. We've got Presbyterian churches that like Bach very much. They'd go crazy if they had much of Homer Rodehiva or whatever the current version is. We've got other Presbyterian churches that members would leave if they had a steady diet of Bach. And we've got some in between where the organist kind of combines the two modes of music, and that may be even worse. But in the process, we have a relatively limited Christian experience, homogeneous. And so when these things come in that look different, it's hard for us without experience of it to affirm the Christian basis of it. But one thing that came to me again and again in my experience in the World Council was that the differences of opinion were soundly grounded in Christian faith and Christian experience. And that's hard for the news to report. It's much easier to make news out of the things that scare people or that will sell papers or and so forth. So that the process of communication is very difficult since it's hard to import into a congregation in South Carolina the meaning of that diversity. It's sort of like the worship at the seminary I teach in New York City. By the time you add up the Lutherans, who are a substantial number, and the Anglicans, who are substantial, the Presbyterians, and the Methodists, and the Black Pentecostals, and so forth, you have to sort of judge at the end of the year whether everybody is about equally mad, or, to back away, about equally puzzled. It would be easier for the Lutherans to have their liturgy every week. And in fact, at our seminary they do. They go off into a little private chapel in order to be familiar in their worship again. But by the time you experience all these different styles, particularly on some controversial things, you do need a sense of your rootage. It does tend to make me more Presbyterian. To appreciate the way we go about things, while I'm much more sensitive to the dangers of liking it too much. And it's that kind of tension that everybody at Vancouver's experiencing right now, I am sure. Larry?
That's very helpful in explaining the responses of Christians in various, here and elsewhere, to the Royal Council of Churches. Is it the same dynamic or a different one that elicits the responses of the secular press in the United States? I mean, if you think of the Reader's Digest articles or the CBS reports, those look with great suspicion upon the Royal Council of Churches, but it's not because they don't understand that Christians differ, is it?
No.
No,
and the question, why is there so much opposition? Now, this one we all need to contribute to. I'll share some of my thoughts about it. One that needs you, that we need to be aware of is the South African opposition. Because the World Council of Churches has been a focusing point for the Christian opinion around the world to say apartheid is not Christian. And the two major white Afrikaans churches in South Africa are not members of the World Council. Most of the other churches are members, and when they come, they cannot publicly say what they really think because it's against the law to say those things, to speak against the government in South Africa. And if you notice, when the key votes are taken, they are not on the floor, and wisely not. But by the time people get to know them deeply, they know how that is. And so the World Council has been a trigger mechanism for mobilizing and expressing Christian opinion around the world about apartheid is not according to the will of God. Now, I come from the part of this country where in 1861, the best theologians of my part of the Presbyterian Church withdrew from the National Church and published a document, a letter to the churches that justified slavery as being according to Scripture and the will of God. And my denomination has borne a heavy burden for 122 years until the vote last month to come back together in a national church. Now, that's how long it took. And that was a deep theoretical, theological question that was set in a context of paranoid sectionalism as we got into the Civil War. And the way that situation, the economic system that was based on slavery in large measure, the political system that reflected the economic reality, led our theologians to what I would say is heresy. The South Africans are in the same situation now. It's very difficult to be a Christian, white or black, in South Africa right now. And that focus of attention on South Africa has been lodged often in the World Council, where the African churches and the other churches, which are sensitive to racism from their own constituents and their own experience, are very powerful forces. I remember one debate where it was on whether the banks should pull out their investments in South Africa. And one of the Africans in the Central Committee said, the question is simple. You should just pull out of Barclays Bank and not mess with it anymore. And one of the businessmen was a British banker, an Anglican banker. And he got up and debated it. And the African said even more bluntly, that's just, you're talking economics, but what you're saying is racist. And the white reaction was, this is the first time in the Central Committee that motives have ever been impugned on the floor. And behind the scenes, the Africans were saying at the coffee break, this is the first time we've ever been honest. So that on that question, the South African question has polarized it in many ways. Now, several years ago, there was a study by, there was discovery that Mulder, in the so-called Muldergate scandal in South Africa, had been using South African Information Service budget to support anti-World Council and positive reaction to South African apartheid and other policies. Millions of rands had been spent in getting articles written and all that sort of thing. one of these books has a review of a study of that whole process made by a British researcher last year, published in 1982. I haven't read the book, but that's one factor. I don't think that's it's that simple by any means. What happens is that when the churches of the world, representing the poor of the world, the third world, when those representatives come and talk about poverty or hunger, for instance, their members are rooted in a situation that is the underside of the positive side we experience. And they say the mechanism of the powerful and the powerless, to be charitable, you got to have some people with a lot to give away and a whole lot of other people needing it. And the way the world economic system now works is to make sure both of those groups continue that way. So that when that issue gets posed that way, you inevitably get questions put that are not easily understood by people like us in the United States, where we are basically the affluent power center of the world, or in Germany or Great Britain. And our reaction is very similar to the reaction of the other major capitalist centers. Now, that sort of thing comes in a wholesale kind of attack. Here at Holden this week, for instance, I'm saying some of these words, Larry says some of these words, Muggy's working on some of these issues. It would be much more powerful if we had about 600 Christians from the third world along with the 300 or 400 here, so that each white person here was in a minority when this issue came up. And that kind of conversation then makes us look in some different ways, through some different eyes, from the basis of different experiences about that. Now, that's why I wanted you to know how to keep in touch with the World Council. It's very difficult to have that kind of experience. It's very difficult to keep up with it and to understand it. And it takes a special kind of effort for those of us who live basically in a homogeneous Christian experience and circles to know how to interpret it, how to understand it, how to respond to it, and even more difficult, how to deal with people who see red flags flying every time something comes up that is not a comfortable extension of the kind of Christian activity we do here. The bell's rung. I'm sorry we didn't get more time to talk. I'd be glad to stay here and chat a while with any of you who'd like to. Let me just say one final word. To be a token American, one of about 10 Americans in an executive staff of 110 or so, is a very educational experience. During those years, our government was engaged in the war in Vietnam. We were bombing Cambodia and not admitting it. We kicked out a president for lying. And the questions that came to an American Christian like me, from Christians who were my colleagues, what's going on over there? Doesn't your country have a Christian basis? Are not the churches in your country strong? Why are you doing things like that? How would you answer? It was a real tough 7 years of my ministerial life. And it's one that makes me end up not feeling perfect about the World Council. It is an expression of the church universal. It has problems that I know much better and much more deeply than you ever can. But the struggle is the glory of the thing. If it didn't exist, we'd have to create it. We'd have to get at it in order to do many of these things we haven't even mentioned, and in order to address the tough questions that are the source of so much misunderstanding among us here in this country.